Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
I'm Kathy with a K.
And I'm Kathy with a C.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is Venice, California. Located just 14 miles from downtown Los Angeles, the city was founded by wealthy developer Abbot Kinney in 1905 as a beach resort town and originally called the Venice of America. When Venice of America opened on July 4, 1905, Kinney had dug several miles of canals to drain the marshes for his residential area and built a pier with an auditorium, restaurant, and dance hall. He also constructed a hot saltwater plunge and built a block-long arcaded business street with Venetian architecture. Venice now enjoys high property values and is known for its famous boardwalk, which draws all sorts of freaks, street performers, bodybuilders, tourists, and the homeless. But Venice of America was once neglected. After annexation, the city of Los Angeles showed little interest in maintaining the unusual neighborhood. Most of the canals were filled in and paved over, and the former lagoon became a traffic circle. The neighborhood was perceived as a dated, obsolete remnant of land speculation prominent in earlier decades. By the 1950s, the neglect had led to the area being labeled the Slum by the Sea. Two main gangs, the Venice 13, which became active in the 1950s, and the Shoreline Crips, which took root in the 1970s, dominated the landscape of Venice. By the late 80s and early 90s, both gangs waged fierce battles over crack cocaine sales territories. And in 1985, it was with this backdrop of Venice's seedy side that one young father lost his life.
Vicente Gonzalez took his wife Maria to a concert to celebrate New Year's Eve 1984. They dropped off their young children with a relative in Venice and headed to the LA Coliseum. The show ended late, and when they returned to the relative's home, they sat in their car debating about whether to pick up their children or just let them spend the night. Vicente and Maria were unaware that two men had crept up on their car until one of them grabbed Maria and held a gun to her head, while the other one opened the driver's side door and pulled Vicente out. Maria froze, fearing she would be shot in the head, while the second attacker grabbed Vicente's wallet, shot him in the chest with a sawed-off shotgun, then threw his body back in the car on top of Maria. Money was demanded from Maria, but she didn't have her purse, so her necklace was torn from her neck, with her attacker yelling, "Look, look," as both men took off running. Maria looked back at the man who put the gun to her head for only a second. Unfortunately, Vicente bled out and died. Los Angeles police detectives immediately suspected gang activity because of the murder's location and the cold-blooded nature of the crime. As detectives searched for leads, a tip came in from a caller who said that their neighbor was bragging about knowing who was doing the local robberies in the neighborhood. The tipster said their bragging neighbor was Denise Powell. Denise was very reluctant to speak to police. Initially, she denied having any information and said many times that she did not want to be involved and she did not want to testify. She also spoke to detectives about retaliation for any information she might give them. But eventually, after hours of questioning, Denise implicated Timothy Atkins and Ricky Evans for the murder and robbery. She said they were the ones bragging about the crime. Detectives then brought in victim Maria Gonzalez, who identified Timothy Atkins and Ricky Evans in a photo six-pack. On January 7, 1985, just 6 days after the murder, Los Angeles Police Department detectives arrested Timothy and Ricky for the crimes. At the time of his arrest, Timothy reportedly tried to run from the police. Timothy was only 17 years old. Both men were charged with murder and 2 counts of robbery. And both Timothy and Ricky were documented Shoreline Crips gang members at the time of their arrest. Ricky had grown up in Venice, but his family had recently moved to the San Fernando Valley, wanting to get away from the crime and violence. Kath, Ricky was in town for just one night when this murder happened because his family came back to their neighborhood to celebrate New Year's Eve with their old friends.
Not long after the arrest, a preliminary hearing was held. The defense did not want to waive a preliminary hearing because they wanted to hear the state's witnesses. Denise Powell was the primary witness, but she did not want to testify. But she was given a subpoena, and detectives told her that if she were called to testify, and if she refused to answer questions, then she would be arrested for contempt. So, of course, she went in to testify. According to her preliminary hearing testimony, Denise Powell was a passenger in a vehicle driven by a young man named Tommy Yates. The two were driving around Venice looking for cocaine at around 8 a.m. on New Year's Day, 1985.
Well,
as one does.
Yeah. I was going to say, well, a girl's got to wake up.
According to Denise, at this time, they encountered Timothy and Ricky on the streets. The two men were also looking to buy cocaine, so they got into the back seat of the car that was being driven by Tommy. About a minute into the ride, Denise said the discussion turned to police activity, and Timothy asked Tommy Yates if he had heard about the Mexican who got killed the night before. According to Denise's testimony at the preliminary hearing, Tommy said that he did not hear about the murder and that Timothy said, "We offed him." Ricky did not say anything about the crime, and there was no further discussion of any crime-related events. After driving around for about 10 minutes, the group did not find any cocaine, and Timothy and Ricky were dropped off. The judge held both men over and sent them to county jail to await their trials. However, one man did not make it to trial. You know, Kath, this is hard to say, and it's going to be hard to hear. While Timothy and Ricky were in jail and awaiting trial, fellow gang members got the idea that either Timothy or Ricky were snitching and ordered them to fight each other. When the gang wasn't satisfied with their fight, like they weren't really into it, they weren't really trying to hurt each other or whatnot, the gang members began beating Timothy and Ricky. And while Timothy suffered serious injuries, Ricky was killed.
Kath, this is so reprehensible and disgusting. They were actually in a cell. They were not in some type of, you know, common populated module. And so somehow, perhaps with the help of a guard, the cell door was left open for these people to come in and beat the hell out of them. And so what happened, as you said, they started getting beat by the other men because, again, they weren't fighting hard enough. And some of the men jumped on Ricky from the top bunk and he died from internal injuries.
That just breaks my heart.
I know. Horrible.
No matter what he did, that's not the way to die.
Horrible. Horrible. The trial for the surviving defendant, Timothy Atkins, began in July 1987. So this is about 2.5 years after the murder.
And on the phone with us now is Lauren, one of our original Patreon members.
The few, the proud, the Patreon.
And she was a member of this jury.
So Lauren, what do you recall of jury selection? How old were you? What was your experience like? Anything you can remember. I mean, I literally know this is almost 4 decades ago. So whatever you can give us, I'm interested in.
Sure. I definitely was fresh out of college, 6 months into my new job with the State Air Resources Board, doing a very boring, unimportant job.
Lauren, aren't you an engineer?
I'm an engineer, yes.
I don't think that's a boring job.
Oh, I was reading warranty receipts from repair records from cars. Believe me, it was quite boring. So I did not mind getting called for jury duty. I was very excited about it. And so we go through the typical jury process where you get pulled in to sit in the spots for the 12 people and the alternates and ask lots of questions. You know, it was very typical of what you'd expect.
Like, give me an example of what you recall being asked during voir dire.
Sure. I remember that the questions related, the ones I remember were, had you ever been a victim of crime? This was a criminal case, so, or, you know, crime related, so a terrible crime. And so they wanted to make sure that we were not victims of crime, that we didn't have any members in our family with that were lawyers or were in law enforcement. And then there was a lot, this was going to be an extended case. So I kind of have a memory that it was 3 to 4 weeks, probably a solid month being away from work, which I was very excited about. So they wanted to make sure that they would have folks that would stay for the whole time and that they wouldn't have hardships with small kids, et cetera.
Did they ask you at all about gang membership? Not your gang membership, but
had you cut your gang ties?
Right.
I hid my tattoos.
Oh, good.
No, they did ask that. There was definitely, if we knew anyone in a gang and if we had experience with people in a gang.
Now, how about, like, did they get into punishment at all, putting people away in prison? I mean, did they ask you your thoughts on that at all?
I do recall wanting to know if the capital punishment was on the table. I, at the time, I was very young and idealistic and absolutely would not have been able to make a judgment. So when they, that involved capital punishment. So when they said, can you make a decision? Will you be able to come to a verdict and be objective, et cetera? I said, well, as long as there's no capital punishment on the table, which it was not. So that kept me in the running for the jury.
Do you remember whether Timothy Atkins was sitting at counsel table? I mean, they don't have to during voir dire, but do you recall if he was present?
I do not recall that. That's one of those, it was too long ago.
So by the time voir dire was done and jury selection was over, you guys were impaneled. Did you have the feeling like, okay, now I'm eager to hear the evidence?
Absolutely. It took a while to get the jury seated because we had to be able to be away from our jobs and families for a long time. I remember getting selected for the jury and going back and telling my boss, you know, I'd only been working 6 months for them. Hey, I'm on the jury. And he's like, no, that's not going to do. And he had me write a letter that he signed to complain to the judge. Hey, she's too important for being on this jury. She can't be there. And I'll be honest, I believe that was once I'd been started to ask questions. I'm like, oh, I don't think my boss is going to let this. And it must have happened before I got impaneled. Anyway, the judge was very quick to turn that letter down. He said, absolutely not. If we can't rely on our state employees to participate in the justice system, who can we rely on?
Oh, so, I love that.
I know. The judge was like, nice try. I know you're getting paid.
Exactly.
Full time. I was no hardship whatsoever. So
none of this $5 a day thing that California does for jury members.
Exactly.
So, Kath, as we said, Maria identified the defendants in a photo six pack. What she said was that Timothy Atkins was the one who took her necklace and
held a gun to her head.
Correct. And that Ricky Evans was the one who shot and killed her husband. However, because of the felony murder rule,
which all of us know that.
Exactly.
Even at Killer Destination School of Law, I've studied that. And it's kind of like a D-level school.
One of these days, I'm going to get certificates. We're going to get law school certificates. I keep saying that. Anyway, so Timothy was charged with murder and robbery. And it is because under the felony murder rule, if you were engaged in very dangerous activity, like felonies.
That's the duh factor.
Exactly. I'm not a very good professor. And
oh, she's the best professor. Don't get it wrong.
Anyway, it is foreseeable that someone could die in the commission of a felony. So all the people who participate, even if they weren't the trigger man, they can be convicted of murder. So that's what happened to Timothy being presented with a murder charge. The prosecution led with victim Maria Gonzalez. She testified at trial through a Spanish interpreter, and she told the jurors about the horrific night that changed her life. And she again pointed the finger at Timothy as the person who stole her necklace. A detective testified that 2 days after her husband's murder, Maria was brought in to look at photo six packs. And according to the detective, she viewed the first six pack and became visibly broken up and upset. And that's when she identified Timothy. Then the detective said, when Maria viewed the second six-pack, she had the same emotional response and picked out Ricky as the person who shot her husband. On cross-examination, the defense raised numerous questions regarding the reliability of her identification of Timothy as one of the perpetrators. And Kath, among the things, like you and I both read this,
right,
and what stood out most in your mind was the height factor.
Right. So she said that the man was around 5 feet tall, weighing between 135 and 145 pounds. Now, the weight thing always throws me too, and Timothy was 175 pounds, but Timothy was 6 feet tall. That is too big a gap for you to mistake that.
That's a big gap. Yep. And another thing the defense pounded on was whether Maria really got a good look at her perpetrator, because she testified she only saw his face for a second. And that was when he had taken her necklace and he's yelling to the other crook, look, look.
And was running away.
Well, like he hadn't yet turned, but you're right. It was very, very brief. And she initially told detectives that he had a thin, gaunt face with a really short haircut, which that was not Timothy.
Well, and then the last thing, Kathy, is that the photo that she viewed of Timothy, and remember, he was a member of the Shoreline Crips, so he'd been in trouble with the law before. The picture in the six pack was of a 14-year-old Timothy Atkins, when in fact, when this crime occurred, he was 17-year-old Timothy Atkins.
A lot of change happens, a lot of growth during that time.
Exactly.
And Kath, one of the things that the defense brought up was the difficulty with cross-racial identification. Timothy Atkins is Black, Maria Gonzalez is Hispanic. Cross-racial identification difficulty is a real thing. And Kath, Denise Powell, who was the star of the show at the preliminary hearing.
She was the one who started it all.
Exactly. By the time the trial came around, she had dipped. Dippity-doo, as you say.
Dippity. I can't sing with this voice.
I know. She's sick.
You're welcome.
So Denise's testimony was memorialized at the preliminary hearing when she was under oath, so the judge allowed the prosecution to read it into the record. Lauren, do you recall the judge allowing Denise Powell, one of the witnesses, to have her testimony from the preliminary hearing read into the record?
Denise Powell, yeah, absolutely. Denise was very important to the case, and I recall that she wasn't available to come in herself. And so they said, hey, since we can't find her, we're going to just tell you what she told us before. So they just read it into the record.
When it was it read in dramatically? Like who read it in, if you recall?
I don't recall who, but it was just very objective and factual, like just like reading a script without, you know, just
like non-passionate, perfunctory.
Exactly.
And then how about like what impression were you left with after hearing her testimony read into the record?
It was compelling.
Why is that?
She was somebody who identified these two gentlemen as the folks who had committed the crime to law enforcement.
So was the fact that she wasn't present a problem for the jurors?
That's a good question. I do remember that it was weird that she wasn't there, and that seemed to have some importance, some weight.
And was this more important than the victim's wife, Maria Gonzalez, saying that she had a glimpse of him?
Because Maria was very emotional. This was very hard on her. I remember very, very sad for her and heartbroken. I knew the area where the crime had happened because grew up in SoCal and Venice Beach. My gosh. So, you know, essentially, it was very hard for her. And I don't have a memory that there was like this very clear eyewitness identification from her. It felt like the testimony from Denise weighed more, at least in my memory, for how Timothy was identified as the criminal.
The prosecution also called a man named Marvin Moore to the stand. But to talk about his input, we have to go back 2 years, which means what? Doodaloo, doodaloo, doodaloo.
Oh my God, Kathy's been smoking unfiltered camels again.
We need to make money so I can quit my day job.
Seriously.
So 6 months after arresting Timothy Atkins and Ricky Evans, police went to work looking for corroborating witnesses. They found one in Marvin Moore. Now, Marvin was a Venice local who signed a declaration under the penalty of perjury 6 months after Timothy was arrested. The written declaration said that in the early morning hours after the murder, Timothy and Ricky ran into the back door of Marvin's home and said they needed a place to stay. Ricky Evans stated that we just blasted a mofo, although he actually used the words. According to Marvin, Ricky also had dried blood on his right hand and forearm. Later that afternoon, Timothy went back to Marvin's home and said that he thought that the police were looking for him. So, fast forward to trial now, again 2 years later, Marvin Moore was called to the stand. He testified that a month before he signed that declaration, he'd violated his parole by committing a robbery and was put in jail. And he was in jail when he signed the declaration. He wrote in his declaration that he was not promised anything, nor did he ask for anything in return for signing his declaration. So at trial, Marvin responded to only a few questions and stated that his family had been threatened. He then refused to answer many questions about the declaration he had signed 2 years prior. Why? Because he said none of his statements in the declaration were true. He only made his declaration to receive a lesser sentence for his robbery charge.
So Marvin was called by the prosecution, Kath, and they knew they had this very, very implicating declaration and they wanted to use it. And they also knew probably that he was going to walk back a little bit, you know, or recant what he said. Okay. So they put him on the stand and they're like, you signed this declaration. It's under the penalty of perjury. It says this, that, and the other thing. You signed it. You read it. Yeah. And he's like, yes. And then, you know, the whole, it's not true. I only wanted a lesser sentence. And then they're like, but you're afraid to testify, aren't you? You're afraid of retribution. So the prosecution made it look as though he really did tell the truth back then in the declaration, and now he's lying because of fear of gang retaliation. Do you remember Marvin Moore?
The jailhouse snitch?
Yes, he was a jailhouse snitch.
Yes, I do remember that name. I wouldn't be able to come up with it on my own, but when you said the name, I'm like, oh, wait, that I remember him.
Do you have any impressions left from his testimony?
I do remember that it was a jailhouse snitch, but that at the end of the day, the weight of his testimony was not, I guess it canceled each other out, because I feel like, I don't remember why, but the police or the prosecutor said, hey, he told us these things, but then the defense attorney made us doubt. I don't have the memory of the details, but I can tell you that we didn't weigh a lot on Marvin.
The defense called Tommy Yates to the stand. Now remember, this was the guy who was driving Denise around looking for cocaine at 8 a.m. on New Year's Day. At the time of the trial, Tommy was serving a prison sentence for cocaine possession. Well, it looks like he found it, because he was looking for cocaine.
Oh my God, you're terrible.
Tommy told the jury at trial that he was driving a vehicle with Denise, as we just said, and confirmed that they had picked up Timothy and Ricky. But according to Tommy, Timothy did not admit to killing anybody. Timothy had only said that the police were around and that it was because somebody had been killed. Another defense witness was one of Denise's neighbors, Kelly Simpson, and she testified that she talked with Denise on January 2nd, 1985, this is the day after the murders, about the muggings and robberies that were occurring in their Venice neighborhood. According to Kelly's testimony, Denise told Kelly that she was at a party and heard two other people bragging about killing somebody nearby. Kelly gave these two people's names on the stand, and neither were Timothy Atkins or Ricky Evans. Kelly further testified that she was never told by Denise that Timothy Atkins committed the murder. Another defense witness was Debbie Dresser, who was a Los Angeles police detective who worked Vicente Gonzalez's murder case. Detective Dresser was aware of an unrelated suspect in other robbery cases who she knew was not in custody at the time Vicente Gonzalez was killed. Detective Dresser believed that Maria's description of the suspect in Vicente's murder matched the unrelated suspect in these other robbery cases. Now, Kath, that suspect, though, was subsequently killed when he was arrested for something else and he resisted arrest. Timothy Atkins did not take the stand.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Lauren, tell us about the deliberation process with the jury, like how long it lasted, was it taken seriously, like just the general behavior of what occurred in the jury room.
Okay, well, first of all, the experience of this trial has stuck with me because it was a whole month. You know, nearly a month is my memory. And I know that when I tell the story of, oh, when I was on jury duty, and it was a 5-day deliberation. It was very long. So the judge gave us our instructions. Everybody took them very seriously. They send you back into the deliberation room and they say, please don't go and take a vote. And of course, that's the first thing we did. take a vote. I would say that of all the rules, that's the one thing that got violated. And I do remember that it was weird because a kid from high school that I knew his older brother, and he was also on the jury. So I'm like, oh, I know your brother.
Wow. For all of LA County, that's amazing.
Yeah. It's like small world time, right?
Right.
And so the first job you're supposed to do when deliberation begins is to select a foreperson or a foreman, as we called it at the time. And nobody was really stepping up. And that's something I normally would have done. I did not this time because I was timid and young. But I remember this kid from high school popping in and saying, oh, I'll do it. And he's young. He's probably 19 or 20. And I just remember that this older woman saying, oh, no. We need somebody with experience. And so she stepped up and said, I'll be the foreperson. And I believe this job weighed very strongly on her. She took it very seriously.
So tell me about that process, about the voting process, and what you guys believe were the most important evidence. Like, how did you come to your unanimous verdict?
That was very interesting, in my opinion, because we did take that vote. And it was not lopsided at all. I don't remember the numbers, but it was, let's just say, roughly even. And so
you're talking about your first vote.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I imagine that we took a few over the course of the time. But once we knew that we were like, there were folks, and I also have a memory that it was pretty like reflected LA County, diverse, young, old, mixed race, all of that. Okay. So I do think it was a good job on the system to get a jury of peers that was kind of reflecting the community. So it was kind of even. So now it's time to do our job. And so how do you do that? You go to the beginning. Well, what did they say about this? What did they say about that? And start stepping through. And so we would go back and ask for the court, you know, hey, would you get us the testimony of this person or that person? And I can tell you that I firmly remember getting the Denise Powell testimony read back. And I can say that after maybe halfway through, at least, things were starting to shift and that folks were more on board with the conviction. And eventually, at some point, at least probably at day 3, it came down to being 10-2. And the two that were not ready to convict were myself and the foreperson, Joan. Everybody else was solid at this point. So in the end, and we mentioned I'm a mechanical engineer, so I have a very logical brain. And even though it was young at the time, it was like, okay, there's only one way to do this. It's a problem. We're going to solve it. So what we did was we went away from the jury into the hallway between the court and the jury room, closed the doors, and she would just say, well, what about this? And I'd say, oh, well, don't you remember? They said this. And we would go back and forth on all of her questions and play devil's advocate or try to answer the questions. And after about a day or so, I remember going, like, I kind of convinced myself he was guilty, right? Because it's all on paper. The evidence is there. The testimony is there. And we, like, every time I tried to answer Joan or she had a question, I had an answer. I could go somewhere and find the answer in the evidence.
Through the course of your conversations with Joan and dissecting the evidence, you came to decide you were going to vote guilty.
Correct.
Really quickly, Lauren, did any of you talk about Ricky Evans not appearing at trial or testifying at trial or any of that? Or were you told that he had been killed in prison?
Ricky Evans was a presence. He was the other guy. My memory is that we were told that their trials were bifurcated or separated. And we did not know then that he had died in prison.
So they acted as if he was alive and there was another trial.
Yes.
So you come to, through your course of conversation with Joan, realize you're going to vote guilty. And so tell me what happens with Joan.
So I was very patient. I do remember that. Like, hey, whatever time you need, let's just, what about this? Any other questions? I know we called for testimony a couple of times and some, you know, we'd ask a lot of questions of the court and we really worked hard. And I worked very hard not to ever make her feel pressured. There was no pressuring from any of the other jurors. Nobody bullied anybody into a decision or, hey, I got to get home to my work or anything like that. Everybody was great. That's my vibe that I remember. And eventually Joan just ran out of gas on what was holding her back. And she came along to the conviction. She's just like, okay. These are the answers. This is the evidence. It's got to be him.
On July 28th, 1987, he was convicted and sentenced to 32 years to life. He filed an unsuccessful appeal and remained in prison.
14 years later, in 2001, Timothy wrote a letter to the Innocence Project. After agreeing to look into the case, the Innocence Project sent a second-year law student, Wendy Cohn, to find and interview Denise Powell. And so, Kath, what Wendy did is she went to the Atkins family. She went to Timothy's family and said, hey, I know you guys know this girl because she was a local girl. Everyone pretty much stayed in the area.
It was a small town at the time.
Exactly. And Wendy also knew that Denise had had a rough life. She had very distinct addiction problems and had engaged in prostitution and was pretty much marginally homeless, I'm going to call it. So what she did is she asked the Atkins family, can you just call me if you see her around? Just let me know. Well, at some point, and this is roughly 4 years after Timothy first wrote his letter to them, Wendy found Denise in a drug rehab facility. Denise had been arrested. She probably was court ordered to rehab, and that's where Wendy found her. And most significantly, she told Wendy that she lied to the police and she was willing to help get Timothy out of prison.
So, Lauren, were you contacted by the Innocence Project around 2005 after Denise was found in rehab?
I was contacted by them. In fact, my husband fielded the call and remembered that I had spoken about this jury experience. And so he confirmed that I had been on the jury. And so I called them back and we set up a time to meet. And we met down at Walt's Wharf in Seal Beach and had lunch. And they told me their story. The California Innocence Project came and said, hey, we want to talk to you about this trial. What do you remember? They asked me a bunch of questions. And, you know, of course, I'm dying of curiosity. Well, why are we having this conversation? And they laid out for me the new information that we didn't have at the time that we made our decision about the conviction. So basically what they laid out for me was that Denise Powell, remember, she was the one who had had her testimony read into the record and was not available. Police could not find her. That she had never moved from the address that the police had on file when she had given that testimony. That she had lived there the whole time for many, many years thereafter. And that she had gone back to the police and said, I lied. They aren't the ones who did it. So the police never contacted her again after making that statement. So for me, sitting there, I'm like, oh my goodness. Finding out that she recanted in the lexicon that she had been lying, that's game changing. And that's what I told the Innocence Project folks. I said, if I knew then what I know now, I'm not sure that I could have convicted him. They had a video affidavit from her laying out what happened and how she recanted and that she was trying to correct the record, that she felt bad about what she had lied about and she wanted to fix it.
So what is it you're feeling when you're seeing this video and you're hearing her recant? Like, what was going through your mind?
It was awful because now I've sent an innocent man to jail and I felt guilty. Everybody tells you, it wasn't your fault that he went to jail, but that's not how you feel. You feel like, oh my goodness, this is horrible. I know that I didn't sleep. I was spinning and feeling terrible and just knowing like, hey, I'll do whatever you need to do to help fix this. And in the end, all I had to do was I did an affidavit that said something to the effect of, if I knew then what I know now, I'm not sure I would have had the same conclusion. I didn't even have to say he was innocent or guilty. It didn't matter. It was just that we were trying to get, like, support the idea that a different outcome was possible. It was horrible.
Yeah, the state couldn't have carried their burden without it. So was there any recommendations you made to the Innocence Project? Like, did you ask them to contact your high school friend or anything like that?
So I was able, you know, they are curious about, like, well, what juror number were you? And I don't know why that was important. But the only thing I could really remember was that I had a high school mate that I could say where he lived and where he's from. So I think they had the names and the cities they were from or something. So they were able to piece together that. And then I was able to tell them that Joan was the Thor person. And that was helpful to them. I remember going, oh, we know who that is. That's good to know that she was the Thor person. I recommended that they talk to Joan because it was Joan, my partner in the hallway, that always had a gut feeling about this outcome. And I remember, and this stayed with me forever, was after the trial, you're done with your jury service, you go out and leave the courtroom, and usually the attorneys from both sides come out and say, oh, thank you for your service, and we really appreciate it. But the prosecuting attorney said, hey, you guys did a great job. Thank you very much. And how did he say it? I just want you to know that even if he didn't do this crime, he did a lot of other bad things and you put a bad guy away. Something to that effect. And when Joan heard that, she didn't fall to the floor, but she just, all the wind went out of her sails. She gasped. She said, I knew it. She was emotionally just, oh my God. She freaked out, you know, in a solitary way. It was horrible. And I remember going, wow. So I always had the feeling like that there was some reason that she resisted so much, that she knew in her heart that something wasn't right about this evidence. And it turns out she was right.
She had that gut feeling, but couldn't put words to it other than it was a feeling that something was off.
Correct. And how could you? Because the evidence, which now we know, was falsified.
Right.
But the evidence was pointing to this guy, Timothy.
On March 6, 2006, the Innocence Project filed a writ of habeas corpus on Timothy's behalf. And what they were doing was asking the judge, hey, we have new evidence. The former lead witness, Denise Powell, has recanted. We want an evidentiary hearing. We want you to hear what she has to say, and you get to decide if Timothy Atkins deserves a new trial. And the judge who presided over the habeas hearing was the same judge who presided over the criminal trial 19 years before. So at this habeas hearing, Denise Powell was required to speak to an attorney appointed by the judge regarding the crime of perjury, since she was going to contradict her prior preliminary hearing testimony that implicated Timothy. Denise agreed to testify regardless of any future legal implications.
Now that's unbelievable.
I know.
I mean, honestly, she's like, I'm willing to go to jail because of what I did all those years ago to make sure he might have a chance at freedom.
Right. And what the judge does, the judge basically questions you to make sure you understand the implications. And if the judge is satisfied that you understand and still want to take the risk, you know, you testify. So Denise said that she spent 8 to 10 years of the prior 20 years in prison for prostitution and drug-related offenses. She grew up and had lived in Venice for her entire life and knew Timothy's family. She also testified that she considered Timothy to be a friend and she had no reason to cause him trouble. She told the judge that she did not know who committed the robberies in the neighborhood. She only told the original tipster that she knew the perpetrators because she wanted to brag and look tough and fit in. Anyway, when she was brought to the police station for questioning a few days later, she testified that she was scared and wanted to go home. But a detective said, you're not going to go home until you provide information to the police. She said they threatened to charge her as an accessory if she did not disclose the information. And the police were like, look, we only want the names of the perpetrators, then you can go home. And you won't have to testify about your knowledge of the crime. So Denise testified that she lied to the police when she told them that Timothy and Ricky were responsible for the murders. And while it was true that the two men were riding around, you know, in the early morning hours of New Year's Day looking for coke, she said Timothy never said we offed him. Denise said she implicated the two because they were fresh in her mind from being in her car a few days prior. She also said that she believed the police would investigate Timothy and Ricky and know that they didn't commit the crime. She never really believed things would get this far. And she told the judge that she testified at the preliminary hearing with this fabricated story because she was already in it so deeply. What she also said at this habeas hearing was that she wrote a letter to Timothy's mother and father stating that her preliminary hearing testimony was a lie. And in 2005, 20 years after the murder, Denise wrote an apology letter to Timothy. She also tried to deliver a letter to Timothy's criminal defense attorney, but was unsuccessful because this gentleman had been appointed as an LA Superior Court judge. So it looks, Kath, like when Wendy Cohn, the Innocence Project 2-year law student, found, well, she probably wasn't a 2-year law student at the time she found her, but Wendy Cohn found Denise in rehab, I think that was when Denise wrote an apology letter to Timothy.
The timing makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Denise also testified that she was coming forward now because she felt so badly about what she had done. And she told the judge that she was available at the time of the criminal trial, but was never contacted by the prosecution after her preliminary hearing testimony. Now, this is a big deal because the prosecution is supposed to prove that somebody is unavailable. So Timothy Atkins also took the stand at the habeas hearing and told the judge what happened. He said that on the evening of December 31st, so New Year's Eve, he left his home between 5 and 6 p.m., and he was going to hang out with fellow gang members for the purpose of getting high. He did not return to his home all night. Instead, he broke into a car and stole the stereo so that he could go buy drugs. But what he did is he gave the stereo to a friend and said, "Hey, go sell this for me and then meet me back here with the money." And Timothy was hanging out near a laundromat. While he's there, and this is like after midnight, he sees three men running down an alley. He recognizes two of them as gang members. He doesn't recognize the third guy. So one of the guys who he knows sees him and says, "You better leave because we just done a move." Timothy obviously knew that they had done something wrong. They were running away, but he knew he didn't do anything. So he stayed at this location. He wanted his drug money.
Yeah, because the guy selling the stereo wasn't going to go look for him.
Exactly. So turns out this location where he was like 0.2 miles from the murder scene. So hours later, Timothy and Ricky are hanging out together. Denise Powell and Tommy Yates pull up. All four of them drive around looking for cocaine unsuccessfully. Timothy testified that while he and Ricky were in the back seat of the car, there was no conversation about them being involved in the murder. Now, at the time of Timothy's arrest, he was on probation for prior convictions of stealing car stereos and receiving stolen goods. He also said he was violating his probation because he wasn't going to school, but he denied trying to run when the police arrested him for a probation violation. So Timothy said he gets to the police station. He's being pressured. He's scared. He's being yelled at. He's being grabbed. And he said, "Hey, you know what? I might have mentioned Ricky Evans' name as being the third guy, but I lied. He wasn't there. He wasn't one of those guys who ran down the alley, and he had nothing to do with the crime." Timothy also testified that when he got out of prison, he was no longer a gang member, and he currently worked with young people to prevent them from joining gangs.
The court found Denise's preliminary hearing testimony to be a significant factor in the jury's conviction of Timothy Atkins. Without the evidence of Timothy saying, "We offed him," he would not have been convicted. The prosecution declined to move forward with a new trial, and in February of 2007, after 23 years in prison, Timothy Atkins walked out of jail a free man.
So if you could talk directly to Timothy Atkins, what would you say to him now?
Oh, I would tell him I'm sorry I was to have participated in the process. I think of him a lot. And Ricky Evans, I mean, those names stayed with me even before the Innocence Project called. It made such an impression. And I'm so pleased to know that he turned out to be a really good human. I think there was a statement that the Innocence Project told me that he said if he hadn't been arrested and put in jail, that he might not be alive today because he was on a bad path. It's not like he said, oh, thanks for saving my life, but he really turned his life around and he really paid it forward. And I just feel terrible that he had to go through this. And I feel responsible, even though I was lied to. And I know intellectually I was lied to, but emotionally that really sucked.
He petitioned the state for over 10 years to get compensation for his wrongful incarceration. In 2019, 12 years after being released from prison, the California Victims Compensation Board awarded Timothy Atkins over $1.1 million. To date, no one has been charged with the murder of Vicente Gonzalez. Just out of curiosity, have you been called for jury duty since?
I have. I've been called a few times. I really believe in the system, and I feel it's our job to help with a diverse jury pool and whatnot. So I always report, and I have since learned that I will never be able to put somebody in jail. Even just the idea of it would start to cause a little bit of anxiety. So now I'll have no problem with the civil trials, but the two times I was called for criminal cases, when I was able to be asked the question, you know, is there any reason that you can't serve on this jury? I would just, once this verdict got overturned, I would say, hey, I sent an innocent man to jail because of police misconduct, and I can never take that risk again. So it usually sends me home. So what's interesting about this experience is that, you know, I have kids in their 18 and 25-ish. And that generation is kind of distrustful of law enforcement and the police with what's gone on in our society these days. And I'm quick to defend it, right? I'm 60, justice is right, and everything's good. But it is this experience that helps me see where they're coming from. How can you believe this guy just because he's a policeman? My instinct is, well, he's a policeman. You trust public servants. You trust the lawyers involved that were the prosecuting attorneys. Everybody on that team was supposed to be the good guys. And now it colored, since this verdict was overturned, that, oh, can we really trust that? And I would say that back in 1984 and 5 and 6, I was definitely anti-death penalty. And then over the course of my life, I probably found exceptions to that in my thinking. But I landed right back there after this was overturned because I just don't see how you could ever be so sure of the system when you can send somebody to jail or to the death row when they could be innocent. And now I know for a fact, I was part of the process, that an innocent man spent 2 decades in jail, and he turned out to be a pretty amazing person, but all things considered, found forgiveness in his heart for the system and the process. But, you know, what if he had been on death row and they killed him? I could never live with that.
So, okay, Lauren, tell us why people should join Patreon.
Patreon's awesome. First of all, it reminds me to listen to the podcast because I no longer have my long commute where you keep me company. So it kind of falls off my radar to download, listen, and delete.
Nice.
So the Patreon emails prompt me to say, oh, there's a new episode. And also the closet interviews or the you ask, we answer. Those are terrific. It's really fun to have sort of an insider's take and to go on vacation with you and hear from your family and whatnot.
Awesome. So, thank you, Lauren. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for your endorsement. We appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Lauren.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Check engine light on. Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.